less time. Hello and welcome, welcome, welcome to the 57th episode of PEM Podcast, the Psychic Eye Mystery Podcast. I'm your host, Victoria Laurie, with my fabulous sister, Sandy, who's extra fabulous today, honey. You look great. You look awesome.
I just sweated my ass off in a Pilates class. So, you know,
it's working for you.
It's so humid. It's so humid here. It's just miserable. Miserable.
Sandy and I have actually spent like the last half hour on Zoom with each other because like it's like we get to like literally be in the same room. It's such a delight, so wonderful. That's why I love doing these every week. And I've been showing her the shoes that I want to buy and the bag I want to buy. So we've been doing like window retail therapy going on. So that's why I have a glow. Sandy sweated her ass off, but my glow comes from Freebird shoes. Yes, because those fucking shoes are so goddamn sexy. Anyway, okay. So getting to the chase, I'm going to promote two books because they're both selling like hotcakes. So Fated for Felony, which is the 16th book in the Abby Cooper Psychic Eye Mystery, and See No Evil, which was published a month and a half ago. Which is the 17th book in the Psychic Eye Mystery series. This one had a cliffhanger that was answered in this one. So it's if you buy the set, then you're not missing anything. I got a lot of flack for ending Fated for Felony on a cliffhanger. And I don't know if I've mentioned it before. The reason that I did that was because I had several fans say or confess that they would just flip to the last page of all of the other of my books and see who did it and then read from the beginning. And
that's such a spoiler.
I know, as someone who so painstakingly works to provide a really twisty novel, you know, and makes every effort to avoid having you be able to guess it early on, I was like, really? Challenge accepted. So so I ended Fated for Felony on a cliffhanger that is actually has nothing to do with the plot of Fated for Felony. It actually is the beginning of the plot for See No Evil. So, you know, I understand that people get anxiety sometimes reading mystery novels and that quells their anxiety because they like have to know. I understand it. But don't say that to the creator.
No.
Why that? Because then we do things to really torture you. So what do you mean there's no answer to this cliffhanger?
Right. Well, I had a woman that I worked for a number of years ago, and her husband had read this mystery novel, and he was like, you've got to read it. It's amazing. And she said, okay, I'm going to take it on my next business trip. So she gets to the end of the book where the culprit is revealed, and her husband had ripped the page out of the book. So she's on the plane trying to figure out who the hell did it. I always thought that was the funniest thing.
That is so mean. Yeah. But like clever. Yeah. Like really, really clever.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's hilarious. That is absolutely hilarious. Don't try that at home.
Yeah, do not.
Divorce City.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're still married. So
I would have been like, okay, serve him. Serve him today.
Right.
When the judge asked, why are you getting divorced? He ripped out the last page of this fucking mystery.
And I need a restraining order too.
Exactly. Why not? Why not pile it on? Okay. Anecdote. I have a great anecdote that I've been waiting to share. This one I've had kind of in the hopper. So I read for a woman who was, I think, in her late 50s. I don't think that she was that much older than I am, if she was at all older than I am. She right away her father came in, and they always tell me like who they are basically based on the placement that they come in at. So when I say come in, they just sort of make their presence felt. It's a pressure, and wherever that pressure is applied tells me who they are. So pressure here is like sibling or spouse, usually. Or could be cousin, could be friend, but usually it's someone in the family tree right away. And then up a little bit, father is on left side, mother is on right side, up a little bit more are grandparents, right? And they try to stick to the side. Sometimes they bounce back and forth. It drives me crazy. But anyway, so he came in, boop, right there. So it was, he was very identifiable by that. And my first question to her was, did your dad smoke? And she said, no. And I said, really? I like, cause he was showing me enough smoke to be like a 3-pack a day guy. And I'm like, so weird. He's just surrounding himself with smoke. And she goes, well, he ran into a burning building to try and save people in the burning building and he perished. And I'm like, oh God. Oh my God.
That's
so
horrible.
That's why. Yeah, exactly. Like he didn't show me flames or anything like that. He just like made it seem like he was constantly chain smoking. That's what he sort of made me seem. But when I was reflecting back on it afterwards, because it was a really extraordinary reading, I did remember that normally smokers make my mouth taste like an ashtray a little bit. You know, it's that gross, like tar taste.
Yeah.
And there was none of that with him. It was just the smoke swirling around. So I thought that was very, very clever. And then, let's see. So he died when she was 10. And he was so filled with love and so filled with pride. So he wanted to show her how he had looked after his family all for the past 50 years. And so he mentioned the graduate that had graduated at the top. And I think she had graduated summa cum laude. And so I'm like, he was at the graduation. He was right there next to you. And then he wanted to mention the artist. And I think there was a professional artist in her family as well. I think that was her granddaughter. He was talking about her love of gardening. She had just been out gardening. And then he mentioned he was holding a cat and he was stroking the cat. And I felt like there was an inside joke about this cat, right? So I said, well, your dad's got a cat. And she's like, okay. And she's like looking around a little funny. She's like, he didn't like cats. And I'm like, well, I don't know. He's like stroking the cat. And I said, and then he starts showing me smoke again. And I'm like, dude, come on, you cannot really. And he's laughing, he's giggling, right? And I'm like, I said, was your cat named like Smokey? She's like, yeah. I'm like, dad's too soon. It's too soon. It's been 50 years, but it's too soon to make jokes about the way that you crossed.
Yeah.
So I thought that, you know, like it's not painful to them to remember how they crossed over because that was just the exit that they used to get over to the other side. But I thought that was hilarious that, he was making a rather inappropriate joke about
got the cat. Yeah.
Smokey is my
cat. I don't like cats, but I'm going to hang with the cat.
Yes, exactly.
To symbolize my peril. I'm curious when you feel our grandmother, right? I know she has a certain energy and you immediately know who she is, but does she show up on the sides where to signify?
Okay. So I will tell you this, you know, we have that really dear friend of both of ours who, we talked about last week, right? Well, we were talking about him and he entered my energy, right? And I was telling you, oh, he entered my energy and he has this to say to you, right? So it's different when it's someone that I know and love who's on the other side. Mm-hmm. When I'm reading for a client, there's sort of an energetic barrier that they put pressure against, okay? When it's someone that is related to me or that was in my inner circle, they kind of come into that energy. So outside people, strangers are outside the energy field, right? The pressure is coming from here. If it's someone that I know and love on the other side, it's a warmth. Mm-hmm. It's like this, they almost inhabit me. It's not channeling per se, but there's a feeling of just being ensconced in their warmth. So that's what I felt for our bud on the other side. And with Graham, when she comes in, she's interesting because she does feel the mom side, but it's all in here. It's all, you know, it's in my inner circle. It's not coming from here. It's like in here. It's really hard to describe.
Well, I was like, just curious.
What the fuck is she talking about? Yeah.
No. I think it makes sense. If it's somebody that you knew, then they would present themselves. Mm-hmm. Leading with love, probably, right? Versus
absolutely.
Identity. And they just
like, it's such a cool feeling. It is this feeling of love, but it's this feeling almost of floating in it. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a protective barrier or yeah. protective bubble that they put you in, and they feel that. That's how you feel their presence. It's like, it's honestly like almost inside of you. Not in a creepy, weird way, but you know, it's just, you're just filled with it.
Yeah.
So my suspicion is that that's what they must feel on the other side all the time. They must feel that kind of like just true essence of love. And yeah. it's really beautiful. And so I love getting in people that I know and love who've crossed over. And then sometimes if they want to just deliver information, like my mentor, Kevin, who crossed a few years ago, it's less that he comes into my bubble and just sort of shoots thoughts at me.
Yes, he would.
Like, yeah. Wake up.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, exactly. watch out. So it's an interesting physiological thing that sort of happens to you. And it's also interesting to me that mediums all choose the same language to describe what's happened. Hmm. Like, we all talk about them coming in. And I don't know why it's coming in, but there's a sense that they move from one area into our realm. There's like that definite sense of transcending from one plane to another. Mm-hmm. You can feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put the pressure on the outside of your, I assume your energy field, you know, your aura, to let you know all sorts of information. And then there's sort of an imposition on your mind of their information or what they want to get across. So your mind sort of plays out images and pictures. So as an example, when this gentleman was stroking the cat, I had this image of a man sitting kind of on a throne, and just stroking the cat and giggling, you know, giggling. I couldn't see facial features. That's never something that they typically show me, but there mm-hmm. isn't a sense of that's a man and he is petting a kitty. Now, what's really interesting is I can usually, not always, but I can usually see the pets like in detail. So that's what's interesting. So I don't know why I can't see the people's facial features, but like our friend, when he was talking about he was letting his hair grow.
Yeah, that was hilarious.
He definitely showed me that mop of hair, so which I thought was hilarious. So he's going back to his hippie days, I guess. So yeah. Fun times. All right. That's it from me. Over to you, my fabulous sister. Take it away.
Okay. So this week we're going to cover the Tetris murders, which has had a number of different television specials dedicated to it. And the Tetris murders focuses on the mysterious death of one of the co-developers of the game, Vladimir Pokilko, and his family. So it's really not surprising that this mystery surrounding the 1998 death of the Pokilko family is like the video game Tetris, which Vladimir co-developed, since both are intricate puzzles with lots of pieces that need to be put together in just the right order. What was originally labeled a murder-suicide, there is now widespread speculation that the Pokilko family may have been killed by the Russian mafia. Born April 7th, 1954 in Moscow, Russia, Vladimir graduated from the Faculty of Psychology at Moscow State University in 1982 and continued to pursue a career in academia as a junior researcher at the I.M. Shebnov First Moscow State Medical University. In 1985, his friend, Alexei Pajitnov, imagined a game consisting of a descent of random pieces that the player could turn to fill rows with seven variants. Alexei titled the game Tetris, a word created from a combination of tetra, meaning four, and his favorite sport, tennis. Vladimir requested the game for the Moscow Medical Institute to conduct clinical psychological experiments using the game. Through his research, Vladimir identified that Tetris would make for a good video game, but he eventually banned the computer game from the Medical Institute to restore productivity. When Alexei reviewed Vladimir's findings and discovered that his colleagues at the Soviet Academy of Sciences also found the game to be highly addictive, Alexei wanted to export the game because Soviet copyright law warranted a state monopoly on import and export of copyrighted works, and the Soviet researchers were not allowed to sell their creations. Robert Stein, an international software salesman for the London-based firm Andromedia Software, saw the game's commercial potential, and after receiving an indifferent response from the Academy, he contacted Alexei by fax to obtain license rights. Unaware that this fax communication could be considered a legal contract in the Western world, Alexei agreed to a licensing deal. And with an agreement in hand, Stein approached other companies to produce Tetris. Following the 1987 Consumer Electronics Show, Stein signed two agreements. He sold the European rights to Microsoft and the American rights to sister company Spectrum Holobytes for £3,000 advance, about $6,000, and a royalty of 7.5% to 15% on sales. Alexei was left out of the percentage sales agreements, and before he could even attempt to make money from Tetris, Soviet authorities forced him to hand over all of the rights, which he did so out of fear of retaliation. Quote, I would have been in prison for sure had I gone directly to Nintendo, Alexei told the Examiner in 1996. I would have had to have been a dissident and possibly be cheated for everything anyway, so it wasn't worth it. In hopes of creating something that would match the success of Tetris, in 1989, Vladimir and Alexei founded the Moscow-based 3D software technology company, Animatech. Meanwhile, legal battles ensued among the world's largest video game manufacturers over the Tetris rights. And in 1991, Alexei and Vladimir emigrated to the United States to set up an Animatech studio in California. Alexei then moved to Seattle, where he produced games for Spectrum Holobyte. In April of 1996, when Soviet restrictions over Tetris expired, the rights to Tetris reverted to Alexei, from which he then founded the Tetris Company in June of 1996 to manage the rights and royalties on all platforms for each Tetris game and derivative sold worldwide. Although Vladimir played an important role in the subsequent development and marketing of the game, and a 1999 article in Forbes magazine credited him for co-inventing the seminal video game Tetris, he wasn't entitled to any of the royalties off the sale of the Tetris games. By 1998, Vladimir was living in Palo Alto with his 38-year-old yoga instructor wife, Yelena, and their 12-year-old son, Peter, a gifted student. While Vladimir concentrated his energy on Animatech, his wife, Yelena, who had been a successful yoga instructor in her homeland, tried to turn a profit with her new American studio. When his business began to fail, Vladimir was forced to lay off workers in Russia and the United States, and his financial woes made it especially challenging to watch friends and former business associates make a fortune from Tetris. Authorities claim that this is what drove 44-year-old Vladimir to murder his family and then take his own life. On September 21, 1989, police arriving on the scene found both Elena and Peter each dressed in pajamas in their respective beds. Two separate hammers were used to fatally club mother and son. They were each then stabbed 11 times with an 8-inch hunting knife. Vladimir then turned the knife on himself and slit his throat. His body was found lying prone on the floor next to his son's bed. Shortly before his death, Vladimir penned a note. Police initially claimed it wasn't a suicide note and they didn't know who authored it, but they later determined it was a suicide note and it stated, quote, I've been eaten alive, Vladimir. Just remember that I am exist, the devil. Sorry, the dabble, D-A-V-I-L. There have been numerous doubts that Vladimir wrote the note. His friend, Grigory Shaperstein, said that he wasn't a religious man and therefore wouldn't have referred to the devil. CSI investigator Sandra Brown also suggested that the note was strange because it was written in the third person and not in proper English. She added, quote, I think that Vladimir killed his family. I did not think that Vladimir killed his family. I remember walking into that room when I slid past the sliding doors, which were already opened, and I looked at Vladimir laying on the ground, and I looked at the blood spatter on the door. I looked at the knife in his hand, and I said to myself, there's no way that this man cut his own throat. Evidence, or rather a lack of evidence, found at the crime scene also doesn't add up to murder-suicide. The knife used to stab Yelena and Peter was washed in the bathroom sink where the faucets, basin, and two hammers were wiped down to remove fingerprints. If Vladimir was the perpetrator, he then wrote his suicide note, burned a set of financial and travel-related documents in his backyard barbecue, and then killed himself in a very peculiar way by slashing himself with a blade gripped in his right hand on the right side of his neck, creating a 4-inch downward cut that was so deep his larynx and his spinal cord were visible. He then slumped over with the knife still clutched in his hand. Investigators only found his palm print on the knife, not his fingerprints. Reinforcing the theory that the Pokilko family was murdered, it was later revealed that the FBI had taken an interest in both Vladimir before the murders and then in a separate investigation into the murder case's connection to Russian racketeering. perhaps because Putin, who was then with the FSB, was notorious for leading a group of oligarchs and gangsters to demand sizable cuts from any profitable homegrown operation. Despite widespread speculation that the Bokilko family was killed by the Russian mob seeking Tetra's profits, and renewed interest in the case because of ID Channel's 2023 part documentary called The Tetris Murders, the 1998 case remains closed as a murder-suicide. People in the Palo Alto community knew the Bohilkos as a happy and loving family, and to date, what truly happened to Vladimir and his family remains a mystery. My sources for this case include Wikipedia, Tetris, Wikipedia, Vladimir Bokilko, The Daily Mail, was the developer of Tetris and his family killed by the Russian mob December 5th, 2022. Forbes.com, The Tetris Murders, docuseries explores mysterious death of the Tetris co-developer and his family by Reza Sarakan, December 5th, 2022. Newsweek.com, The Tetris Murders, delves into the mystery behind horrific 1998 murder case by Simone Carter, 12/5/22. And The Daily Beast, The Tetris Murders, explores the sinister theories behind the video game co-developer's grisly death by Nick Shager, December 5th, 2022. So, Victoria, I know you have a very strong opinion and impression about what actually happened.
Well, the second we started talking about this case, I was like, it was Russian Mafia. Before I knew anything, it was Russian Mafia. It's so obvious to me. And I think what is really disappointing is that there apparently, it looks like there were a number of individuals within the Palo Alto PD that were either instructed to look the other way, go along with the suicide idea. And if you watch that documentary, which is really, really fascinating, I watched all three episodes and was like really engrossed by it. It's just so obvious that there was some form of corruption happening either inside the FBI and also the Palo Alto PD at the time, along with the county Emmys, the county coroners as well, because those two autopsies that were done. So basically there were two autopsies done on Vladimir. To ensure that it was homicide, two homicides and suicide. And both of the separate coroners determined that it was a suicide. In the documentary, Sandra Brown is speaking with a forensic pathologist named Dr. Michael Arnall, and he goes into why that could not have been a suicide. And that's truly fascinating. So basically, it comes down to the fact that Alexei's throat was cut, but the carotid artery was not. So the jugular veins were. Vladimir's neck was cut, and it was cut. He was holding the knife in his right hand, I believe, and he cut down. So trying to get a knife in and down, and then the wound was so deep that the spinal cord was exposed. So the reason that the coroners were determining that it was a suicide was because there were two other hesitation marks, two other cuts in his neck that they determined were hesitation marks that is often present in suicide victims. However, those hesitation marks, suicide hesitation marks, would be absolutely indistinguishable between torture marks, with torture marks. So it's obvious to me that they were torture marks, that he probably was held in front of his family as they were murdered. And then he was hit with a hammer because they also noted a U-shaped bruise at the top of his, I think, temple. And it wasn't enough to crack the skull, but it could have absolutely rendered him unconscious. The blood splatter from the cut to the neck was really low. So it's almost as if he got down on his knees, leaned forward, and then jammed the knife into his neck and didn't cut across, cut down. So the carotid artery was not cut, which is a high pressure vein. The jugular veins were cut, which are low pressure veins. You're going to die in a couple of minutes, but you're going to die in a couple of minutes versus the carotid, which is, you know, really quick, really quick.
The other interesting thing is that at the scene where he's lying prone, his hand was gripping the knife. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to cut yourself, you're going to spasm and drop the knife. You're not going to hang on to it. And then when they examine the knife for fingerprints. They only found a palm print, right. No fingerprints. And in the right. sink where the hammers and the knife had been wiped clean, there mm-hmm. were no fingerprints in the sink. And this was a family right. bathroom. So there should have right. been fingerprints right. in the bathroom.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So, so none of it adds up. And it's interesting that you mentioned spasm, because the knife was found in his hand and it was attributed to a, it's called a cadaveric spasm. So cadaveric spasms are when you have an injury that's inflicted on you that does not allow you to breathe. You can't breathe. And so your whole body tenses and it cannot relax. So you die with your fist balled or whatever you're holding in the grip, right? So this pathologist who was on the documentary had done over 5,000 autopsies and is one of the foremost leading forensic pathologies in the country. And he said, I've never seen a case of cadaveric spasm. And he said, and I don't know anyone who has. In theory, it exists, but he's like, I've never seen it. So, so given that he had minutes to die, like he could have gone and checked his email, ordered a pizza, you know, during the time, like the time that it took for him to die. What's he doing? He's holding onto the knife and he's just lying there sort of waiting, you know, and there's no attempt to cover the wound. There's yeah. no, like, I mean, that hurts, right? Right. And, you know, how do you stop yourself from doing that? So he was probably knocked unconscious, then his throat was cut, and that's how he was murdered. The note is really odd because his Vladimir's English was better than that.
Way better.
So yeah. So like it's half in English, and then Davil is Russian. So I have a feeling that the two torture marks might have been sitting in front of the computer, having to type out his own suicide note. So terrible. And then the documentary also notes a number of other oligarchs who were killed in a very similar fashion. So it turns out that the FSG, which is like basically the secret police in Russia, in the 1990s, sort of perfected making deaths look like suicide. And they were particularly, like there was a sort of particular pattern, which was you kill the entire family and you make the head of the family appear as if he has murdered his own family. So there were other cases where, you know, a 9-year-old daughter was murdered and her mother, and then the father was also murdered. So anybody who fell out of favor with Putin was basically, you know, killed. And that's an ongoing theme. How many oligarchs have to fall out of a window, you know, before you're like, something smells fishy. So it was definitely a mob hit. I think when I focus on it, I can feel two assassins. But I also sense that there might've been a third. There might've been a third because the room feels full. So one took one room, the other one took the other room, murdered the wife and son. And then there was a third probably handling Vladimir. It's sort of my sense. That's what happened. I cannot imagine watching your family slaughtered like that. I mean, that's your child. Like,
his son was beloved Vladimir for sure. It was also interesting that Animatek was losing money. And I mm-hmm. think the Russians felt that it should
they didn't
be earning
know
money.
No, they had no idea.
Right. So when
they didn't
he had
know
to lay,
he was losing money.
Right. So when he had to lay people off in Russia and then in the United States, that it looked like, what are you doing? You're supposed to be making money hand over fist. It worked with Tetris. Why isn't it working with Animatek?
Right.
Which only had moderate success in the beginning.
Right. They had Russians have no understanding of how American business functions, especially not in the 1990s, because they were so fresh from the Soviet state. Yeah. So of course they're not going to, you know, and it is a mafia state. Like it's a mafia state. So insurance is basically, you know, their way of paying taxes. And nobody owns anything over there. So, bad. And the FBI, the other thing that the documentary noted was the number of Russians that were coming into the United States, basically to strong arm Russian business owners who had fled Russia to open up businesses here into paying their quote unquote taxes. So there were a number of assassins, there were a number of strongmen that were just funneled into the United States to sort of watch over Russia's interests, so to speak. And the FBI was tracking them. The other really interesting thing about this case is how quickly the FBI showed up. They were basically at the scene. And there was also a subpoena that came from the Southern District Court, the state Southern District Court, for all of the evidence. It was within, I think, 2 days of the murder. So, I mean, that doesn't happen. Like, you have to get a grand jury together. You have to have them take a vote, et cetera, et cetera. That's a process.
Yeah.
So there was obviously an ongoing investigation into Vladimir, maybe not into any sort of criminal activity, but they probably had heard or gotten wind that he was marked and they were observing the scene. And I think they probably dropped the ball, which is why they shared zero information with the local police.
Palo Alto police. Yeah.
And then were quick to try and cover up any evidence, which is, I think, where the pressure came in from the two medical examiners. You know, this needs to look like a suicide homicide, not a triple homicide, because there are unanswered questions that may lead back to us. So I think that the FBI was involved in sort of, not necessarily a cover up, but in lending credence to the idea that what you're seeing isn't what you're really seeing. Because I think that essentially they had dropped it. I think they knew that he was marked and they didn't warn him and they didn't provide him any kind of security. And he died in this really horrific fashion. And because he was tied to Tetris, it became a national news story. So that's what I think.
Do you think the case will ever be opened, reopened, reevaluated? No.
Because there's no one to blame.
Right. That's true.
So unless you have an FBI, old FBI agent, retired FBI agent coming forward and, you know, saying, yeah, we knew we dropped the ball. They're not going to do that. Why would they do that? There's no incentive to do that.
Right.
You know, so yeah, that's one that's going to be, you know, don't believe your lying eyes, you know? So.
Well, thank you for the added insight and the added research. I think it makes for a richer
writing it up.
And flubbing up as I was talking.
No, you're fine. You're fine. There's a lot of like Tetris-y words in there.
Yeah.
The other thing that I noticed, I just wanted to call this out because I thought this was a brilliant form of cinematography, was the documentary takes place. They have all these different characters and the setting in which they seat them is like, it looks like a Tetris. If you could take Tetris and put it in architecture or a scene, that's what it would look like. So they have like long couches and then a sole person sitting on the couch and really tall ceilings. To each scene with each different person has a very interesting backdrop, a very interesting scene. So someone was, I think, very purposely giving a nod to Tetris when they were designing the sets where they shot these interviews. It was really
interesting. I didn't even pick up on that scene. Yeah. It's like,
well, I kept seeing like, why are we so far away from that person in that huge room? Yeah. He's this one sole guy living on this really long couch. And then I'm like, oh my God, it's the shape of a Tetris. So it's really fascinating. I thought they did a really good job with that. So
excellent. All right. So next week we will be doing a famous case and we're going to invite a special guest to help us discuss the case. And looking forward to sharing that with you. And we will try and be more timely week to week with our cases.
Now that Sandy's taking over, yes, we'll be timely.
Anyway, thank you everyone for tuning in. If you would like to learn more about Victoria.
Oh, head to victorialaurie.com. That's where you can find out about my books. That's where you can find about booking a session with me, a private psychic reading with me. And we have a list of all of our podcasts there too. So podcasts in one central location. I've also started a Patreon page, have a lot of people signing up, which I'm thrilled about. I'm really, really thrilled about. Thank you to all my Patreon supporters and subscribers. I'm putting a lot of really cool content on there, including I'm going to do a regular AMA, Ask Me Anything. So I'm going to try and do that at least once a month, probably twice a month. I'll either be live streaming it or I will just be answering questions as we go. So you can literally ask me anything. I give the rules sort of at the beginning. Yeah, no, seriously, you can ask me anything. Anything that's going on in the world, anything that you need some intuitive advice about, you know, you can ask me anything. I don't have to answer it, but you know, you can ask me. I'm kidding. So we had one the other night, and yesterday I was complete vegetable because it was really intense. I think I answered 50 intuitive requests for insight. So in an hour, it was machine gun style. My poor radar, man. Oh God, I was faceplant into the bed. But it was great. It was really great. I also do a segment on the Patreon page. And Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon. So if you just do Victoria Laura Patreon, it'll take you right there. I think there's a link too on my website. Yeah.
There is.
We also do what's called a Dear Victoria. So you can send me a request to give intuitive insight on a specific topic that you have. The topic needs to be specific in the form of like a Dear Abby. So Dear Victoria, blah, 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 blah. And then give yourself a pseudonym or an anonymous name. And if you don't, I'll make one up for you that you may or may not like. So that's the scoop. That's it. Okay. Well, so thank you, Sandy.
You're welcome. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please click the like button. Subscribe to our channel. And if you have any suggestions, by all means, leave them in the comments for cases that you're interested in having us cover in the future. All right. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Very much appreciate it. And we'll look forward to seeing y'all in a week.
Bye, guys. Take care.